So this is the Ohio Writers Guild, and we get to interview some amazing authors every single month. And I'm Kathy Benner. I'm a passive income coach, but one of my favorite lanes is writing. And I have an international academy where I also, Sandy and I teach together there, and we have a little mastermind going on. So if anybody's interested in that, check it out. And then we do these meetups every month where we get to talk to a different author and all type of genres. So if any of you in the audience are also authors and want to be featured, just get in touch with me and let me know. And I'm going to put in, and of course, I've covered up my keyboard here with all my information about Marion. So let me change this. And I'm going to actually type in my website. So if anyone wants to get in touch with or learn more about the academy or anything that we do, you can go to kathybenner.com. And I love writing. I've often said it's a dream recovered, not a dream discovered, because when I was probably 12, I remember being such an avid reader. And I told everyone that I was going to be a writer someday. It's never too late. You know, I mean, I did corporate America for years and, you know, I mean, I've been out there. And so now I'm writing. It's okay. It's never too late. So
that's true.
So, one of the most popular books is Lessons in Chemistry. And it's been popular for months and months and months and months and months. And she is 67. So years ahead behind her. So you're a youngin'.
Well, you think I'll be 67 on my next birthday.
Oh, wow.
Yeah. So I'm in good company. Yeah. So anyway, so check out kathybenner.com. All of the masterminds are there. Everything I'm doing is there. You can find the free replays for this will be posted there. And I was just sharing with the gals that once this is finished tonight, we do take the recording and we upload it into a podcast, and it comes under Kathy Benner Freestyle Living. So if you want to look up the podcast, the Freestyle Living podcast, you will find all of our podcasts there, all of our different lanes, and this one included. So anyway, that's what I do. That's about me. I started this, but I found Sandy. I just fell in love with her as soon as I met her. And I thought, oh, she's the gal. She's the one that I want to be my co-mod, my co-host. So I am now going to segue over to Sandy and let her tell everyone in the audience what it is that she's doing. And it's so exciting. So take some notes, Sandy.
Hi there. I am Sandy Kaczurek, and I direct Into the Springs Writers Workshop in Yellow Springs, Ohio. But it's in its fifth year, different iterations because things change and adapt. And I have also have been fortunate to have moved it from a tiny little community center room to the Mills Park Hotel, which is right in the village of Yellow Springs. And by all means, look up Yellow Springs, Ohio. It's almost like Oz. It sort of exists all in its own and in a lovely sort of way. So I am fortunate to be in a town that admires artists, admires writers, and that gives it such a great energy. In it, I have a workshop that usually features, so far at the most, three featured guests. I try and change up the types of genres that are written every year. The real tricky part is the fact that these featured guests stay in the same room with everybody else from Friday to Sunday noon. Puts a lot of stress, but yet there is this attraction and community that grows, and you're able to go at your pace. You can act like I was just talking about writers, for all their crazy worlds they live in, they're shy sometimes. So in one session, the featured writer is out the door. You don't see him or them again. Here, you share lunch together. You're in between. You take the breaks together. There's always a moment, I hope, in a very small, personally owned boutique of a hotel to ask your question eventually, to seek advice eventually. And that's what I work hard. And the fact also, when you have these instructors all together, can they speak to an audience that comes from so many levels of experience and so many genres? And yes, there's a part of that. They shine in their own right, but they also have an ability to talk to a group of people who may come from all those different areas. This year, I have Jane Friedman. If you're a writer of any kind, by all means, look up Jane Friedman and follow her wherever she's at, mostly online. She is fantastic in marketing, publishing, the digital age, definitely, although she was editor-in-chief of the group that put out the Writer's Digest ever so long ago, until she saw that the future was not in print. It's going to be in digital. So she moved in that direction and is quite fantastic at it. You get her for a whole weekend. She's usually like, say, a keynote speaker or a webinar, one-person webinar. Now you have her for the whole weekend. She's talking about trends and no doubt AI and chat, what AGTPT are all going to be a part of it. And independent or traditional publishing, she's going to do both. Or she's going to, and with Jason Sanford, who's really known for his out there, science fiction and fantasy, he's going to talk about writing tips. He also is going to talk about short story writing, Patreon. So all along the way, these two experts and artists are going to move you along. Effective First Lines, we were talking about, where you'll get to read your first couple pieces of your opening lines of a story, and they're going to decide, hey, is an agent going to pick that up, an editor? Why or why not? And then that night, we celebrate. We have a book writer, the two authors bring in their books to sell. And then afterwards, we have open mic reading night, cash bar. And we spend the evening where you get to read 5 minutes of your piece. Last year, I was hoping I had five people read it, and I ended up, everybody did, and we ran over for a couple hours. So we're going to make a night of it. From 8 to midnight, cash bar, those two actors are going to read the pieces if you don't want to, and it's going to be good. We celebrate. 7 to 8 a.m., if you want to write before everything gets started at 9, that's fine. We're going to have writing Saturday and Sunday. And we have Saturday lunches included, and refreshment bar will be there the whole weekend too. So that's everything I hope you would love in a workshop.
All right. Sounds so great. Here's what I want to say to the audience that's listening right now. If you want to be a painter, you have to hang out with painters and see what they're doing and how they're doing it so that you can really get good at your craft. If you want to be a writer, you have to hang out with some writers and see what they're doing, how they're doing it, so that you can get really good at your craft. So come to the Writers Workshop, hang out, see what's going on. This is going to be so educational. When I went to my first Writers Workshop, what I discovered was that little segment where they're critiquing that work was the best education that was worth the ticket of the whole workshop. Because it was a big aha moment for me. Like, that's what the editors and publishers are looking for. Aha. And so books are a business. So make sure that you rub elbows with all those folks. So come out and join us at the Writers Workshop. We'd love to have you. For the Kathy Binner International Academy, we have made Sandy's Writers Workshop our tribe trip for that weekend. And so I'm promoting it within the masterminds that I'm teaching. On any of them that we have like three lanes where there's writing. We have blogging, and then we have the writing, the Ohio Writers Guild. So anytime I talk about writing, I mention Sandy's workshop. And so please come out and join us. It's going to be fun. Now, tonight we are talking to Marion Boyer, and Marion is the author of several poetry collections, including Composing the Rain, which won the 2014 Grayson Books Poetry Chapbook Competition. Marion is a professor at Kalamazoo Valley Community College. She served on the executive board for Kalamazoo Poetry Festival from 2014 through 2016, and was the feature poet for Wisconsin Washington's Island Literary Festival in 2018. And since moving to the Cleveland area, we're all Ohio gals here tonight. She is now serving on the planning committee for the Lit Youngstown Literary Festival and conducts workshops for the Lit Youngstown and Literary in Cleveland. So welcome, Marion.
Thank you very much.
Yeah, that's great. I do have a couple of questions for you.
Okay.
I mentioned that when I was like 12, I was reading all, I loved to read, and I would carry so many books around because I never wanted to be without a book. I loved I loved the thought of story. I love that. Mm-hmm. And so I love to read. How early do you remember that you wanted to be a writer? I mean, tell us about your backstory. How did you happen to decide to do this? What was your path?
That's interesting. I love to read too. I loved to read poetry. I loved Edgar Allan Poe. I read Edgar Allan Poe by flashlight under my bed covers so that I could stay up. And I loved the language of Poe, you know, and I loved the language in poetry. But I didn't really see myself as a writer in school, although writing always came easily to me. English classes, I could write my way out of almost any essay question because, you know, I could just kind of write along until the teacher either got bored with my answer or said, okay, that's enough. She's got it. I really didn't pursue writing until much later when I had my kids, and I decided I was going to be a children's writer. That was my idea. So I went to Chautauqua in New York for the Highlights. They have a 1 week, incredible week long workshop for people who want to write children's stories. And I'd had a book, I had a short story published in Jack and Jill magazine. So I figured, you know, I'm on my way. I learned that week, No. I'm really not a children's writer. It is hard. It is super difficult to be a good children's writer. And so I kind of gave up the dream. I learned a lot along the way, but I gave that up. And then when I was in Kalamazoo, Diane Seuss was teaching a class for adults in poetry writing. And the way she described her class really appealed to me. It was, you know, no judgment. We're going to have a lot of fun. It'll be free. Mm-hmm. And I went, and light bulbs went off. And ever since then, I've been taking workshops or teaching workshops, but I've been in the poetry world, and that suits me. I'm not going to ever write a novel. I'm not a person who invents fictional stories. I can tell someone else's story. I can tell a story, but inventing a story like you're inventing your story, Kathy, that's not my bag. It's just not.
It's not easy. Yeah, no, it's not easy. I've always written, educational material for my for my academy. So this is the first time I'm writing fiction, and I'm discovering it's not easy.
Oh, it's not. It's not at all easy. And I'm happy writing essays. Very happy writing essays, which are very much like writing poetry. I think, but telling a story well, and especially a story to a child, without, you know, talking down to them and not saying something that's already said, been said a million times. It's really hard. It's really hard. So I'm going to stick with poetry. It's my lane, and
okay. Now, how did you know that you were ready to write that first poetry book? The very first one, when you think back, how did you know you were ready to actually put it into a book and get it published?
Yeah, well, by that time, you know, I'd been writing poems and sending them out and getting them published. So, you know, every time you have an editor say, this is worth publishing, you feel a little more encouraged, right?
And where were you sending them at that time? Where were you getting them published individually for our poetry writers in the audience?
Well, in Kalamazoo, there's a wonderful Kalamazoo magazine, local magazine that comes out once a month. called Encore, and they would publish two or three poems in there. And so I started local, which I think is really a good thing. Start locally, your newspaper or whatever. And then I just started gunshotting. Diane Sue said plaster the universe. So I was just plastering the universe and found that the poetry journals that liked me, then I would send again and again.
Okay.
So like Rhino in Chicago was one, Spoon River Anthology was one. And I was feeling pretty good. I took a workshop from a writer, David Dodd Lee, and there were a number of women in his workshop my age. And he was saying, you know, you should think about putting your poems together in a chapbook, you know? And we all looked at each other like, are you crazy? I mean, no. I think every single one of us has published several books since that workshop. So he sort of said to us, you know, you've got something going here. You should do it. So my first chapbook was Green. It went to Finishing Line Press, and it was kind of an assembly of poems that I was successful at doing, kind of group, some about my father and Alzheimer's, some were sort of speculative. I was kind of writing sci-fi poetry. That was a section in the book. And then I wrote a whole series on a fellow named Jake Luck, who was a whitewater guide in the Grand Canyon, who I read up about and created a series of persona poems in his voice that people liked. So that book was sort of an assembly of things. Yeah.
So what does a day look like for you? Do you set aside a certain time every day to write, or is it just when the inspiration, you're like, oh
yeah, I'm gonna make everybody feel really good. I have no discipline whatsoever. No. Fortunately, I have a critique group that we meet via Zoom every 2 weeks. And so we expect one another to have a poem. So, you know,
Nothing like a good, healthy deadline.
Yeah. So having a critique group that you're answerable to is invaluable, because you kind of pull something off. And then when I moved to Ohio, I met a wonderful person who lives in Akron, Barbara Sable, and she and I clicked like you two are speaking about. And during COVID, we would send each other a poem a week to critique. We would have it on our computers and talk on the phone. And I wrote Ice Hours that way. And she created her book, Watermark, which is being published about the Johnstown flood. We both had common projects. We were both writing about historical events in lyric form. And it was so helpful to have somebody to bounce ideas. And we had similar problems, you know, and that we had to solve. So
give us a little snippet. What kind of a problem might you bring to the table for those that are listening? Like poetry, I write poetry. How can I maybe get some of my poetry published? How could I get it into a book? And what kind of problems was it that two of you discovered that needed solving?
Okay. Well, one of the advantages to our two projects were we knew we had a story to tell.
Okay.
So a lot of people, when they're putting together their first poetry book, they have a lot of poems like I did for Green. And they're like, how do these go together? How am I going to make that into a book? I didn't have that problem. I had to tell a story that started in 1914 and ended in 1917. So all I had to do was fill in the storyboard, right?
Okay.
That was great. It was the closest I've come to being a novelist, where you know, okay, this is going to happen in the plot. And so today I'm going to tell about May 14 or whatever. It is a relief for a poet, because when you're writing poetry, you're always starting over every day. It's a blank sheet of paper and you got to do a brand new thing. Whereas if you're a novelist, you're plugging into a storyline.
Right.
But
so did you plot this one out then?
Yes. Well, I had to, yes. And I plotted it out in a file And I just, every page was, you know, I'll call it a scene. So yes. In this scene, Spencer Smith dies. Well, I'm not going to write that poem today. So I would write on the page, write the poem about Spencer Smith dying. And then I'd assign myself another thing, you know, write about the dog dying or whatever I had to do. It was very satisfying to know that I could go in and just say, what do I feel like today? Okay, I'll do Spencer Smith, right?
Okay.
So those were the advantages. The disadvantages were, I'm talking about real people.
Mm-hmm.
And I'm talking about historical facts. And I'm talking about people from another country than mine with a different vocabulary. And I have to honor all of that, but condense it and make it lyric. I have to make it different from a person who writes a nonfiction book about these men, right? Mm-hmm. I have to make it different from the men's actual diaries, which I had access to. It had to be poetry. So that's one of the challenges, let's say. Another challenge is I had to summarize in a book, you know, 2.5 years, and I had 10 men who were in Antarctica. I had men on a ship. I had a lot of characters that I needed to keep straight. And once I got them straight, I needed to keep them straight for the reader. I had to figure out, how am I going to make the reader know that these guys are very different? And so that was a problem.
Now, did you have a particular platform or what tools are you using to keep track of this plot, keep track of your characters, keep track of the scenes? Did mm-hmm. you have a particular software or a tool mm-hmm. of some sort that you, or did you do it manually? Did you have a big cork board like they do at the police station?
Yeah,
you
know, here's the whole... that would be cool. No, I literally had a open Word document and just sort of laid it out, even with the blank pages. And then, you know, the other problem I had was my cast of characters are all men, right? And I wanted a female voice in this story. So where's that going to come from? So I have sometimes when one of the commander's wife is thinking about him, of course, she can't write him a letter or anything, but she's thinking about him. So I have her voice enter in, and I designate her voice for the reader. Well, in the title, it's always Gladys. That's her name. But I always use the same poetic form for every one of her poems, mm-hmm. a triolet. So every time Gladys spoke, it was a triolet. I had another character who was an Anglican minister, Spencer Smith, and very formal, wonderful man, not suited for this trip at all. And every time Spencer Smith speaks, it's a sonnet.
Huh.
So that it's subtle. I sometimes,
but the reader starts to recognize the voice.
It's possible. Yeah. Yeah. Those were little ways that I helped cue a reader. And then I needed another ability to go from micro to macro, you know, these men in a tent. So the voice of Antarctica comes in as a voice, as a female voice.
Mm-hmm.
The continent speaks. And of course, she is unaware of these men as much as your body is unaware of what's going on at a cellular level. I mean, she's totally macro. And what was interesting was, that's how I entered the book myself. I became imaginatively empathetic with a continent that separated from all of the others and drifted to the bottom of the earth alone. And I identified with that because I had just moved to Ohio. And I didn't know anybody. And then COVID hit, and it was extremely lonely. And something about writing in Antarctica's voice was very satisfying for me. Yeah. Yeah.
Marian, this is also fascinating. It has never occurred to me to even go down that lane of writing poetry. This is, I just feel like I've learned so much just in the few minutes that I've talked with you. So if I run across folks that are really, you know, that's their thing is poetry, I feel like I get it, you know, mm-hmm. where before mm-hmm. I'm kind of like, oh, okay, whatever. Cause I was never a big poetry reader.
Sure.
And I'm certainly not a poetry writer. So this is so interesting to me. So you've told us a little bit just in sharing all of this so far, what the Ice Hours is about. Can you give us just kind of an overview of what that mm-hmm. poetry is about?
Mm-hmm. The book tells a story that very few people know. And I've been haunted by this story for 20 years. Most people know Ernest Shackleton went to Antarctica with the idea of crossing the continent. The idea sprang from the fact that Scott died and it crushed people in England. They loved him and they loved his noble quest of getting to the South Pole first, but he didn't make it. So Shackleton said, well, here's what we're going to do. We're going to go across the continent. That was in 1914. What people don't understand is in order for him to cross the continent, he needed supply depots from the halfway point to the rest of the trip laid for him. Otherwise, there was no way he could haul enough supplies for himself and his men to make the crossing. It was literally impossible. So if you think of Antarctica like a clock, Shackleton goes to the 10 o'clock position at the Weddell Sea on the Endurance. Of course, he sinks. And then there's that whole story, which everybody knows. But at the 6 o'clock position in the North Sea, or in the Ross Sea, is the crew on the Aurora. And their job is to offload and lay the supply depots to the South Pole. And they have 2 years to do it, 2 seasons to do it. And they have no idea Shackleton's not coming, right? So they continue to lay the supply depots, even though their ship, the Aurora, gets swept out to sea with their own food supplies, clothing supplies, and equipment. And yet they know if they don't lay the depots, Shackleton will die. So they are starving. They are snowblind. They have scurvy. Their dogs are dying. And they complete the job. They lay those food depots for Shackleton, who never comes.
But of course, they didn't know that.
No. And three died in that effort. And it's always struck me. People say, yeah, Shackleton saved all his men. He did. On the Endurance, but the Aurora are often forgotten. So
wow,
that's their story.
Why did you decide to write the story of the Ross Sea Party?
I was told the story a long time ago on a family vacation in the Grand Canyon by a friend, and the story haunted me. I went to the Chicago Field Museum, saw an exhibit of Shackleton. It was tremendous, but nothing about the Ross Sea Men, and it kind of made me mad. I wrote the director of the museum and said, you've forgotten these guys. And I got no response back. And I thought, there's something about these men being forgotten that drives me crazy. And I knew I had to write the story, but I didn't know how to do it. And then Melinda Muller, who's a wonderful poet, wrote the Shackleton half, the Endurance half of the story in a lyric book called What the Ice Gets. And I admired that book so much. And I thought, well, I'm going to answer her book with my book and tell the other half of the story. And so I did. And I'm very pleased. I sent her a copy. She did a blurb for me. I don't know her at all, but it's a lovely thing. Yeah.
That is a lovely thing. Mm-hmm. How was writing this so different from the other poetry that you've written?
Well, it was magical because I already had the story to tell. I just had to figure out my approaches and how to do it. And it was almost all persona poetry, which I love to write, but I had to write it in these voices and make them authentic, sound like these men. And they were from different strata of English society, so they sounded different. They had different vocabulary, so there was that challenge, and that was different.
You have to do a lot of research to what does that look like, researching these men? What does that look like?
I read every book written about them and have all of those books here. And I must have read each of them many times with notes and marginalia, right? And then I read about Antarctica, the continent, and then I read about the job of sledging. And then I read an entire book about ice, the types of ice, the categories of ice, the words, the names for ice. I mean, for somebody who likes language, who read Poe under a blanket because you love language, you have like 50 different words for ice, and you're just going to go crazy. I mean, it's wonderful. So yeah.
Dennis wants to know, how many books did you read?
How many books did I read? I read probably 4 really good books about the forgotten men, the Ross Sea men, and they are identified in the back of the book, in the glossary. I read the book about ice. Then I found online access to the journals, the actual journals that the men kept.
Oh, my goodness. So what a goldmine. Were you so excited when you found that?
Oh, yeah. It was amazing. It was amazing. And then, even better, I found a book written by 2 of the men had written a book. Richard Richards and Ernest Joyce both wrote books. So I read those. I read a book by about Shackleton. Again, I get disappointed because nobody talks about the Ross Sea men in that. And then I found, and this was magic for me, I found a recording of an interview of Richard Richards, 60 years old, remembering it. He was in his 20s at the time. And it's an hour-long interview of him, and he chokes up thinking about some of the moments. And of course, I fell in love with him. But to hear him speak.
Wow.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. So all of those things help me in my small way inhabit these men.
Why did you decide to make the continent have a voice?
Well, I wanted a female voice throughout the book. I wanted the macro. Mm-hmm. Right. I wanted to scale way back out because, I mean, 2 years and all of this suffering, but I mean, in the scale of geologic time, it's nothing, right?
Right.
So I wanted that contrast. I felt the book needed the richness of the contrast of the macro versus the micro and the female versus the male voice. Yeah, it seemed like it was required. So what wound up happening is I open each segment of the book. The book has segments, and the segments are opened with Antarctica speaking. She's remembering being tropical, which she was. Mm-hmm. And she's remembering splitting off from the other continents. She's thinking about the weight of the snow. I read in this book about ice, the weight of the snow on the ice dome deforms the sphere of the earth. I mean,
that heavy.
Yeah.
Wow. Mm-hmm. This is just the research that you've put into this. What do you want us as a reader to think of these men after we read the book?
Yeah, I mean, of course, I've spent so long with these men. I want you to love them like I love them, and feel empathy for them. But I understand that these men were doing this right at the beginning of World War I. And in the book, I mention what's happening in World War I at this time. And it seems very frivolous for them to be in Antarctica doing this when their countrymen are home dying by the thousands. They never thought the war would last. The war was, England had just declared war when they sailed off. Mm-hmm. And they decided, well, we can go off to war, but that's going to be a flash in the pan, or we can do this exciting thing. And in fact, the rescue of the men at the end, the seven men that remained, was in jeopardy because in England, they were saying, and in Australia, they were saying, why finance all of this production and redo the Aurora ship to go down for seven men when we have catastrophic death happening with the war still going on, right? So, yeah, I don't know how people feel about the men. I can't direct a reader. I mean, a lot of readers would say it's foolish. A lot of readers would admire their gumption. These men did not get along. Some of them were not suited for this adventure. There was all kinds of difficulty. And yet, you know, they did it. Mm-hmm. So at some level, you have to admire the gumption, the courage.
In what way do you see yourself in the book?
I can't see myself in the men. I see myself in Antarctica.
Yeah.
I grew up loving NASA and the space age and wanting to be an astronaut. And so if I see myself in the men at all, it is that desire to go where no man has gone before, you know, that, uh-huh. that adventure. But I know myself very well, and I would really lightweight down in Antarctica.
I love everything about this. I am so happy that you're on this evening. I want to open it up to the audience if you have any questions. And Sandy, how about you? What thoughts and questions does this spark in your mind? And for those of you that are in the audience, pop your question or your comments, even if it's just some kudos to Marion, pop those into chat for us.
Yes, I was, the reviews that I had read, as soon as I heard and read that Antarctica makes an appearance, I thought, oh my gosh, everything just glittered. someone called it her brooding, and that line as being stripped off of her clothing and burrowing beneath the shield of ice. It's almost like she's there, she's not there, but really, and this is my interpretation, it's all about her. Yeah. It's all about what these men are doing in her, on her, with her, beneath her, all that sort of stuff. And I thought, this is it. And when you talked about your, and I'm going to blather a bit, Kathy. Maybe
no, you're fine.
But when you talked about influence of Edgar Allan Poe, I could see it here. There, you know, he tells a story. Yeah, it's a raven. Yeah, the raven says nevermore. But there's a whole story that unfolds. Mm-hmm. And it's dark, gothic. And then there's Lenore and all the other poems that he's written and his short stories as well. That whole, there's more than just some characters doing some stuff. There's a lot more, and you've reached that. And when you mentioned the word empathy, and I read the word empathy, and I think, you know, all these years, the little bit that I've explored of my poetry and the most that I've loved, how history from Langston Hughes, I Too Sing America, and how you're flipping things. And in each case, and when you mentioned about feeling like Antarctica, I thought that's the empathy. I go, maybe empathy is really, really a key ingredient to when, for me, poetry expresses itself the most. Like Oliver, who does her nature poetry, And that's it. Just amazing. And here you are, and someone else comment about weaving history and science. That is about as unpoetic as one can get. How do you wave that magic? And it's not that easy, but you take it and you interpret it differently. You get into the empathetic situation of the setting, the characters, the action, the plot. Mm-hmm. Just amazing. Just amazing.
Okay. Thank you. A couple of things I want to say to you, Sandy. That I appreciate you mentioning Antarctica stripping off her clothes and burrowing. And I read about hypothermia. Mm-hmm. And in the severest case of hypothermia, that's what people do. They strip their clothes off and burrow in the snow. It's a confusion of heat and cold. It's so weird. So I had Antarctica be hypothermic at the end, because Antarctica, the continent, isn't the ice. She's under the ice. She's buried in it. There was something else you said, but how do I write about history poetically? You pay attention to music. Form helped me a lot. If you're not familiar with poetry, you won't notice the forms, which is fine. But I used a number of formal poetic devices. For example, I used sonnets, I used triolets, golden shovel, pantoum, glossas. There's a lot of formal form. And the advantage of using formal form is it requires certain tricks with the language. You have to have these lines rhyme. They have to have a certain meter. They have to have a certain format on the page. So that assisted me from making it all just prose, right? There's a writer, a poet that I really like, B.H. Fairchild, and he said the difference between prose and poetry is prose tells you what about something. Like a prose version of the Rossi men tells you about their experience, tells you about everything. But a poet writes not aboutness, a poet writes isness, meaning,
wow,
I'm not telling you about it, I'm making you experience it. I'm putting you in it, what it is. So I'm not telling you about frogs, I'm making you become a frog, right?
Yeah.
So that's what I think poetry can do when you're writing about history or writing about science that prose can't do. And that's my goal anyway. That's what I try to get to.
Yeah. Well, Cynthia says she agrees with Sandy that it was magical to hear Antarctica's voice. And she said it made perfect sense once she understood that. And Kathleen wants to know, how did you decide on the title?
Oh, yeah. Thank you, Kathleen. Well, I was reading that book about all the types of ice, Frazzle ice, pancake ice, grease ice, all of the types of ice. And I came across the term ice hours. And it's a scientific term. And it was originally a Russian term for Russian scientists in Antarctica that has to do with the position of the sun in the sky and the first time the ice freezes and adheres to the land. That's an ice hour. And I loved that, even though I can't explain it very well scientifically. I loved the sound of ice hour. And then, of course, the men are there for months and months, but every hour they are there is an ice hour. It's always ice, always. And so that's how I chose the title. I'd written the poem, and the poem is Antarctica speaking, and she says, all my flowers are ice flowers, all my hours are ice hours. And there is a construction of ice called an ice flower. I have pictures of it. They look like blooms like this on the ice, like lotuses And those are ice flowers. It's a formation of ice. So that's when I had my title.
Yeah. Well, Teresa said she was so glad that she was able to be here tonight and how you came to write this story, the macro, micro voice considerations, your research. She said everything was so interesting. She said you are that wonderful combination of writer and teacher. She said you can show and tell so eloquently and simply. Kudos. And the distinction on poetry versus prose. So she really enjoyed this evening. And while we still have you on, let me find it here. I had it a moment ago. Someone asked if you could read a section.
Oh, sure. Yeah. I think because we've talked about Antarctica, I'll read one of hers. Do you want to hear the ice story of Antarctica or when she's remembering she was tropical? What do you want? You don't know. Okay.
I think I'd like the ice story.
Yeah, I was going to say. The vocabulary of ice? Okay. Yes. All right, let me find
ice.
All my flowers. Shoot, I thought I had it marked. And
while you're doing that, Sherry says, thank you, inspiring her again and again. Kathleen says she didn't know the scientific meeting between the flowers and the ice hours. And Teresa votes for the ice story.
Okay. So I found it. It's on page 50. So here we go. All my flowers, Antarctica. I know ice, whalebone white, green and turquoise, milky ice, ice blood red when the algae blooms, candle ice, pack ice, pancake ice, and cat ice that glazes water so thinly a breath would shatter it. Lolly slush, loose crystals in a saltwater slurry, young ice and its false maturity. I know the way fast ice locks on and doesn't let go, the gray moray of grease ice, its sheen of watermarked silk skimming the sea, and fog ice, mists of diamond dust that cancel skies, that conjure multiple and dazzling suns, bounce prisms, throw halos, suspend a snowfield inverted in midair. The ice gives birth to ice. The first filaments of ice mating are frazzle ice. Once it develops and grows muscular, ice battles ice. The ice barrage explodes in a din of booms, cannonades, cracks, loud as rifle shots. And when the ice buries ice, it is entombed with ancient atmospheres. All my hours are ice hours. All my flowers are ice flowers.
Wow.
Thank you. The diamond dust in the air creates visual things in Antarctica that aren't seen elsewhere. These halos and these mirages that flip, invert snowfields. Mm-hmm. The diamond dust does weird things with the sunlight and creates weird effects, sun dogs, halos, mirages. It's very strange. Yeah.
Wow.
Thanks.
Marian, this is wonderful.
Thank you for this opportunity.
Yes. Thank you so much for being on. How can our listeners connect with you?
Well, I have a website, marianstarlingboyer.com.
Okay.
And I'm happy. And there's a connection with email. My email is m3boyer@gmail.com. So I am teaching for Lit Cleveland. There's a summer class coming up that I do with my buddy, Barbara Sable, my soulmate. We are teaching a class that's gone on for a while. A number of these people are in the class where we read contemporary poetry and talk about it. It's great.
I love that. Thank you so much. Teresa says Marian's teachings for Lit Cleveland are superb. Done many, and will continue. Yes.
Yeah, nice. Thank you.
Yes. MarianStarlingBoyer.com. So tap in. And I'm sure there's a contact me page somewhere within your website as well. Mm-hmm. So folks can get in touch with you that way if you're taking notes.
Yeah.
Now, for those of you that are on your computer or on your cell phone, I don't know how you're tapping in. You can do a screen print if you want to save anything that was in the chat. Or if you just tap the three little dots. Oh, maybe not. I don't know that it'll give it to you guys. I think it'll just give it to those of us that are on stage. But so take a screen print if you want to save anything. But remember, MarianStarlingBoyer.com. And again, if you want to connect with me, it is at KathyBinner.com. And Sandy is, hers is IntoTheSpringsWritersWorkshop.com. And so make sure that you connect with us. And I got a new message coming up here. So glad that you read that one.
Good.
Excellent teacher as well as poet. Thanks for this program. So I want to just say thanks for everyone for being with us this evening. This has been a lot of fun. I'm glad that everyone is here. I'm especially glad that Sandy's here and that Marian is here. And we will be posting the replay. So if you want to share this with any of your friends, feel free to do that. And you can just click through at KathyBinner.com and find the replay in the free Ohio Writers Guild. So thank you for that. And thank you so much for being with us tonight.
Thank you so much.
We will see everyone next time.
Yes. Thanks, everybody. I really appreciate it. Thank you so much for your time. Thank you, Kathy, Sandy.
You're very welcome.
Bye now.
Bye.